Hello and welcome back to Death and Taxes, a private wealth podcast from Burgess Salmon. My name is Tim Williams and I'm delighted to be joined by my colleagues from our tax and trust team, Guy Broadfield and Sarah Carlyon.
Hello.
Hello.
We're expecting 2024 to be an interesting year in the world of private wealth, not least because we have an election looming and the main parties are beginning to set out their visions of how the UK's tax regime should change. Once we have more detail on that, you can expect several podcasts exploring what's being proposed and what it might mean in practice. In the meantime, we thought it would be helpful to summarise how some key aspects of UK tax law work at present, so that the future changes can be understood in the right context. This is part two of our look at the detail of inheritance tax, and we're going to take a deep dive into the two key inheritance tax reliefs, business property relief and agricultural property relief. So Guy, in the context of talking about business relief and agricultural property relief, why are we worried about reliefs?
Well, when it comes to questions of tax, and tax liability, clearly it's our job to look at the rules and see what they say. Now, in the case of inheritance tax, as we explained last time, we're really looking at transfers of value from one person to another or from one person into a trust and working out what the taxable value is of those transfers. Now, the great thing about reliefs and indeed exemptions are important to any tax lawyer or an accountant or anyone looking at this. You know, if you can qualify under the rules and meet the conditions for a tax relief, then in many cases you can reduce the value to zero for tax purposes, such that you don't have any liability to tax. Now, in the case of business relief or business property relief, this is a particularly important tax for inheritance tax purposes because, broadly speaking, if you meet the conditions, then it treats the IHT due on a transfer of relevant business assets as being zero. So your liability is reduced as a result, and it's an important estate planning succession consideration as a result.
And it's really important to lots of our clients, Guy, isn't it? We have lots of clients who run businesses of all different shapes and sizes, and you made a really good point that actually this is about looking at the detail of what's going on in any particular business and working out whether the criteria for the reliefs are met. So Sarah, do you want to just at high level talk about what those criteria are and the main principles that we're looking for when we talk about business relief?
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose for the purposes of today, we're looking at business assets and property which qualify for the 100% relief. There are some interests which can qualify for 50%, but more commonly, we're looking at businesses or interest in a business. So that could be a sole trader or a partner in a partnership. And we're also looking at unquoted shares, so shares which aren't listed. And for these purposes, shares listed on the AIM market are not quoted. So anything falling within the above can qualify for 100% relief from IHT. And so when it comes to what qualifies for business property relief, as it says in the name, it needs to be a business. Now, business isn't defined in legislation, which means really we need to give it its ordinary meaning, which generally means a professional vacation, which is carried on with a view to making a gain. But what the legislation does do for us is tell us what won't qualify as a business for business property relief. And that is a business which is wholly or mainly consisting of dealing in securities, stocks, shares, land, and very importantly, the making or holding of investments. So when we're looking at a business and whether it qualifies, what we really need to be looking for is whether the business is wholly or mainly trading rather than investment. Now, when the courts are looking at whether you kind of meet this wholly or mainly threshold, they look at the activities in the round, and it needs to be over 50% trading.
And that's a really important concept, Sarah, isn't it? That we've got this distinction between trading activities and investment activities. And as you said, the legislation sort of talks about not being an investment company, but for shorthand in most discussions about this, we talk about being a trading business. Guy, do you want to talk a bit about what the activities that might be trading and what might be investment for us?
Yes, sure. So, I mean, in the pure case, you'll know a trading company when you see one. It's a company that makes widgets or provides certain services or deals in procurement, for example, or makes a particular hardware. It looks like a you know, a trading company from the outset. Now, in the investment case, you might have investment companies dealing with property, for example. So how do they make their money? Well, actually, they make money from rental income, from interest in land, for example. And it's more of a passive business activity, and it looks more like an investment. Now, of course, the more difficult examples are where you have a hybrid business, which has some elements that might be trading, i.e. making things, and some elements that are investment related, i.e. more passive rental income type arrangements. And so when it comes to business property relief, a key consideration is where you fall within the wholly or mainly test if you are a hybrid business.
And that wholly or mainly test is, as you said, Sarah, it's you've just got to be more than 50% trading. And it's a test that looks at different sort of elements of the business, isn't it? It looks at profit, it looks at income streams, it looks at capital values, and it looks crucially at time spent by employees. And then you take a step back, as you said, Sarah, and look at the business in the round. And that's, you know, you said, Guy, that you'll know a business of a particular type when you see it. And there is a sense that once you've weighed up all of those different elements, you do have to sort of have this sense of what it does the business look like in the round. Does it really look like mainly a trading business, or is it mainly an investment business?
Yeah, and I mean, underpinning that, there will be certain financial data that will tell you where you are on the line. So, you know, the case law will tell you need to look at the amount of profit turnover that's attributable to the trading elements and the hybrid, the investment elements, the number of staff that's attributed to one or the other, man hours. And you take out all those pieces of information together, and then ultimately, you come up with a conclusion at the end, whether you're wholly or mainly trading or not. Should be said that BPR can also apply to holding companies where, you know, they hold shares in trading subsidiaries. That's a difficult, a slightly more distinct analysis, and not particularly easy, and not one for a pod necessarily. But in that case, you know, you've got a company that can still qualify for BPR, provided that its underlying subsidiaries are trading, even though its job, it's in broad terms, is to hold shares itself, which might otherwise look like an investment activity.
Yeah, and that's quite a complicated analysis, isn't it? That does come up quite a lot in practice, and can be result in lots of forensic detail. And that detail point is important, isn't it? Actually, you know, you mentioned there, Guy, there'll be financial data backing that up. And in so much of the tax world that we encounter, your paper trail is really important. Because as we've said, you've got to claim this relief. You've got to demonstrate to HMRC that you qualify. And how do you do that? You do it by providing information to them through your accounts, which need to be laid out properly to reflect the different areas of your business. And you need to have information to hand about, you know, what your staff do. To have information to hand about what the business actually owns. It might sound obvious, but, you know, kind of in some circumstances, particularly where there's lots of group companies or lots of companies doing different things as part of the same business, it's important to know what is owned where and where particular activities are happening to be able to properly identify whether the relief would be available to any or all of those parts of the business.
Yeah, and HMRC will look at that information in detail, and, you know, it is within their power to reduce the relief that's available if they think that there are aspects of the company or the business that aren't fully trading. And so one of the key considerations when it comes to BPR and the availability of BPR is to look at, yes, how the company makes its money, but then also what it has on its balance sheet. You know, does it have surplus cash, for example? Because that can be something that HMRC, if it sees a big cash balance in a company and it says, well, that's all well and good, but if it's not earmarked for any particular commercial purpose, it looks like you're just sheltering cash in a company. And as a matter of policy and the legislation, we're not going to give you relief on that cash. So that's a bit of a detailed point, but there are rules that kick in if, you know, HMRC chooses to look at your business in detail.
And Guy, I think it's worth saying at that point that we've got this concept of you know, large cash balances, and what the rules call that is an accepted asset. But that's slightly different from where you've got a mixed business that consists of trading and investment parts. What the rules say there is that even though if you had the investment part of the business on its own, it wouldn't qualify for relief. If your business as a whole is wholly or mainly on the trading side, those investment assets can qualify for relief. Now, that's not to say that you can just stuff your company full of investment assets to shelter them from inheritance tax. You do have to maintain that balance, but it is worth noting that, you know, assets that wouldn't otherwise be relievable by themselves can qualify for relief as part of a wider business. Now, of course, that's a double-edged sword, isn't it, Sarah, that if you go too far the other way and you become wholly or mainly an investment business.
Yeah, that's right, Tim. So in those circumstances, you wouldn't be able to benefit from the relief. And there's also wider accepted assets that business owners need to be aware of. So assets which aren't wholly or mainly used for the purposes of the business, those also won't qualify. So you really need to look at the detail of your business to see what qualifies, what's accepted and so won't qualify, and whether you can kind of fit within the medium of some qualifying despite you having a minor level of investment.
Yeah, and the final point to note is that you've got to have owned these assets for at least 2 years before they will qualify for business relief in your hands. And the other point is that these can't be subject to a binding contract for sale. And what that means is again, quite detailed. But if you've agreed to sell something, then you probably lose the relief. So with that in mind, Guy, what's the sort of most valuable point that we tend to see BPR being applied?
Well, at a high level, it's the fact that it reduces the value for IHT purposes to zero. But looking at that more substantively, what that means is there is still scope, if you have business assets that qualify for relief, to transfer those assets into trust in such a way that there's no inheritance tax payable. Now, that should be compared with, you know, if you've just got cash, for example, then as we explained in the last episode, broadly speaking, as an individual, you're limited to putting £325,000 into trust every 7 years. Now, if you've got shares that qualify for business property relief or business relief, then you meet the conditions. As we've explained today, you know, the value for IHT purposes of those shares is zero. So if you then transfer those shares into trust, then you can get more than £325,000 worth of shares into trust in one transfer and not pay any inheritance tax. So if you have, let's say, £1 million and you transfer that into trust, you're going to be paying, looking at 20% immediate charge on the balance above £325,000. If you've got £1 million worth of shares that qualify for business property relief, well, there's no immediate charge to inheritance tax because the value of those shares for IHT purposes is zero. So this remains one of the last ways that you can get significant value into a trust with the benefit of relief.
And that trust point is important, isn't it? Because trusts are, you know, but part of that is about tax planning for the people giving those assets away. But also trust, particularly in the context of a family business, can be very important ways of maintaining continuity of control, keeping value within a particular family group. So it's a valuable way of preserving control of those shares in one part of a family, but also passing the benefit down to another group of people.
Yeah, it's a way to hold those shares in a long-term vehicle for the benefit of various family members. Sometimes it's for a business where, you know, that business is going to continue hopefully for many generations to come. In other cases, we see this type of planning in the run-up to a sale or an exit, because in those circumstances the family can transfer shares into trust with the benefit of the tax relief, sell the shares, and then you've managed to get the cash proceeds into trust in a way that wouldn't be possible if you had waited, sold your shares, and then looked to transfer the monies into trust afterwards. So it's an efficient way of getting much more value in if you are considering selling shares.
But crucially, Guy, you've got to do it before you get to the point of having a binding contract for sale. So if you're thinking about doing this, do it early, because otherwise you run into that potential pitfall of the BPR code.
So really what we've been talking about here with business property relief is a specific type of inheritance tax relief for certain business assets. as you mentioned at the start, there are two main reliefs we're going to talk about today. And the second is agricultural property relief, which in broad terms is an IHT relief that focuses on the agricultural value of agricultural land and buildings. And in its own way is equally as important to certainly the agriculture and farming sector. So Tim, do you want to just say a few words about its importance and how it operates in practice?
Yeah, thanks, Guy. I mean, so a bit like Sarah mentioned with businesses in the context of BPR, agriculture isn't actually defined in the legislation. But what we really mean is land and buildings used for food production. Now, farmers at the moment have probably got a fairly clear idea of what they're using for food production and what they aren't. But there's an interesting question at the moment as environmental land management schemes become more prevalent, as basic payment scheme falls away and farmers are looking to replace their income with the new schemes designed with a more environmental and ecological bent. Some of those schemes are going to be happening alongside farming, which is probably fine. But where they are towards the more extreme ends, then there is a question mark over what that means in the context of APR. And there's a consultation that closed last year. I'm still waiting for a response on what that looks like for tax purposes. But I think what it brings out is this sort of slight uncertainty about what activities fall within APR. So what is clear, though, is that lands and buildings will qualify as well as farmhouses. And farmhouses is an area where there's lots and lots of case law, lots and lots of different discussion about what is a farmhouse for the purpose of the legislation. And it can be particularly valuable because you know, the farmhouse might be a very valuable house. And the farmer needs to claim relief on that, although otherwise they might have to sell it or sell some land to meet the tax bill.
So Tim, let's say I've got some agricultural land, arable or land used for livestock, and I've got some farm buildings and a farmhouse that's character appropriate to all of that. Do I have to be the farmer in order to be able to claim APR? Do I have to farm that land myself?
Well, not necessarily. So there is a relief for landlords. So if I own land, but someone else occupies it for the purposes of their farming business, provided I've owned it for 7 years and they've used it throughout that time for agricultural purposes, then I would also get relief on the land. Now, the question then comes back to the farmhouse, because the farmhouse needs to be occupied by the person in day-to-day control of the farming operation. So landlords are not going to get APR on their farmhouse, whereas active farmers should do.
And we should also point out, Tim, that if you are the active farmer, then the ownership period or qualifying ownership period for your land, provided you actively farm the land for agricultural purposes, you need to have done so for 2 years. And so in that sense, it mirrors the ownership condition for BPR.
Yes, that's right. So when we're looking at APR, it will only apply to reduce the agricultural value of the land. Now, it's important to highlight that that's different from the market value of the land. The agricultural value of the land is the value of the land if it was subject to a continuing covenant that land could only be used for agricultural purposes. So it may be that you have a piece of land which has an agricultural value of, say, £250,000 and a market value of £300,000. You can benefit providing you meet all the conditions. So, for example, if you have a farmer who owns the land, is farming the land, and he's done so for 2 years prior to the transfer, he can benefit from APR on that first £250,000. He then, if he's operating a farming business on that land, can potentially benefit from business property relief on that final £50,000, meaning that the £300,000 could potentially benefit from 100% relief.
And there are all sorts of factors on this area that might mean you've got non-agricultural value. So it might just be straightforward amenity. Someone might pay more than someone who wanted to make a living from the land would pay. But it also might be things like development potential. So if you've particularly got land around the edge of a town or village, say, that might get planning consent, a developer may well pay quite a lot more than the agricultural value for that property. So BPR becomes really important in those sorts of circumstances.
So I think, you know, the conclusion we can draw from both APR and BPR is that, as we said at the outset, they're significant tax reliefs, and provided you meet the conditions, they can be very valuable from an estate planning perspective. It should be said that some individuals and families, and possibly trustees in some circumstances, combine business property relief and agricultural property relief in a very effective way to mitigate inheritance tax. And in those cases, they structure the ownership of their land, the ownership of commercial interests in such a way that shelters significant value from IHT.
Exactly. And there are, you know, there's an argument that that has impacted on land prices across the UK in recent years. But, you know, it's something that for particularly sort of larger farms and larger estate clients, this has been, you know, part of what keeps their business running from generation to generation. And, you know, in if we think about what these inheritance tax reliefs are designed to achieve, the sort of primary objective was to preserve businesses, keep farms together, so they could be handed down through the generations. Now, there's a wider sort of policy piece here, isn't there? And over the last, you know, 5 years, particularly, but, you know, over time as well, there has been scrutiny on APR and BPR, whether the tests are right, you know, within the context of APR, whether let land should still qualify for relief. I mean, none of these questions have been resolved. They're still very much alive and kicking. But it is likely that the spotlight will stay on these reliefs, particularly in the run into the election and maybe in the next parliament as well. Thanks, Guy, and thanks, Sarah. And thank you for listening to this episode of Death and Taxes, the private wealth podcast from Burgess Salmon. You can listen to our previous episodes and get in touch with the team at burgess-salmon.com or on our LinkedIn page. And we'll be publishing new episodes every fortnight on Tuesdays. And as parties publish manifestos ahead of the expected election, you can also look forward to our thoughts on what their policies might mean for private clients and their advisors. Don't forget to subscribe, and thanks again for listening.